You're listening to the Crossridge Women Podcast. The following is teaching audio from our fall 2023 study in the book of Nehemiah. For more about us and to access our resources, you can find us at crossridge.church/W study. Okay, where were we? Where are we? We are tonight, we are talking about Nehemiah 9, all the way to chapter 12, verse 25 or 26, 25. As this whole chunk goes, 9 to 12, 25, there is a large part of it, basically all the way from 11 to 12, 25, that is just lists of people, a lot of names of people. You know what? We're not going to do any work tonight in 11 to 12, 25. If there's something that you need to ask me about from there, you can ask later on tonight, or you can come find me afterwards. But all I have to say about this is that, once again, I would tell you, these are lists of people who were faithful to God because God had been faithful to them. And these are the people, right, that are resettling Jerusalem. So sometimes in these big lists of people, for our purpose of study, and particularly for our purpose of study, we don't need to like look at every single name and look them all up. We can just say these lists of people are people who are important to God, who he loved, who he was faithful to. They were faithful to him. And by them, actually, this faithful remnant, one day the Messiah will come, because they volunteered to inhabit the city and they chose to go live there and to carry on the work. Is that fair? Okay, so we're going to leave behind now 11 to 25, and we're going to focus mostly on 9 and a little bit in 10 tonight, because I hope you loved Nehemiah 9. Did you love Nehemiah 9? If you didn't do the homework, you can totally unabashedly say, I have not done the homework. That is okay. We're going to read a lot of Nehemiah 9 together. And I think if you haven't read it yet, you will see that it is a beautiful passage and it is worth going back to. Here's where we have to establish ourselves where we are in this book, right? So last week, we saw that the people's identity was going to be rebuilt, and they started with the reading of the law. So they got God's law, they assembled the people and God's law, and they read from God's law, and the people understood it. And their first instinct was what? Do you remember? Yeah, they were sad. They were mourning and grieving and weeping, right? Because they saw what was true about God and this covenant, and then they saw that we have not kept it, and they started to grieve. And the priest said, no, 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 now is not a day for mourning, because it was actually a specific holy feast day according to the calendar. So he said, actually, this is a day for rejoicing. So I want you to remember that the joy of the Lord is your strength. And one thing that the priests and the Levites wanted the people to know is that actually it is the kindness of God that even leads your heart towards this mourning and grieving. So first of all, let's worship and honor God. And so they did that. They celebrated and they feasted, but then also they kept the law by celebrating the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. So that's where we just came out of. And when we get to chapter 9, verse 1 says this: on the 24th day of this month, the Israelites assembled. They were fasting, wearing sackcloth, and had put dust on their heads. So now has come the time for them to actually mourn their sin. That is what they are doing. And we know that because what they're wearing, that they're putting dirt on their heads voluntarily, and they're fasting. Okay, that's just signs to us. When we read that in the Old Testament, we know they are lamenting and confessing their sin. Okay, so we should just say, first of all, now is the time for mourning and confession. That is what we're going to be reading in chapter 9. But I wanted to read verse 2 because it can be sort of a difficult verse, so let's read it. It said, "Those of Israelite descent separated themselves from all foreigners, and they stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their father." So the very first time I read this, I was like, oh, why do they have to separate themselves from the foreigners? Like, that sounds mean. I don't know if you guys have that sort of instinct that it's like, wait a minute, like, what's going on? These people are special and the foreigners are not good enough, so they have to separate themselves. And by the looks on your face, you're all looking at me like, no, we did not have any problem. We know exactly what's going on there. You are alone in this because we've got this handled, right? Is that true? Yep, okay, that's true. It's just me. Okay, so just making sure, okay, what's happening here? Why are they separating themselves from foreigners? Because they are idol worshipers, so they have to separate themselves from idolaters. But actually, are they idolaters? Because it describes them later, and they actually signed the covenant. In 1028, these foreigners that they're separating themselves, it says that the foreigners, everyone who is able to understand and who has separated themselves from the surrounding peoples to obey the law of God. So there are people in God's people who are foreigners, who have actually separated themselves from their homeland and their home people, right? They are not Israelites, and yet they have chosen to follow God and to keep company with God's people, and they are actually welcomed into that. So the reason why the Israelites have to separate themselves is because they are about to confess sin. And they are going to confess the sin of not keeping the covenant, okay? They are going to confess the sins of their fathers and their fathers' fathers and their fathers' fathers' fathers, because they were responsible to keep this covenant that God made with Israel. The foreigners among them actually had no responsibility to that covenant. That covenant that God made with Israel was not made with these foreign people. They actually didn't bear responsibility for the sin of the people in the same way that Israel did. Okay? So in what is happening here is that the actual Israelites are separating themselves from other God's people who do not happen to be Israelites, because they were not under this covenant, and yet they have been brought now into the covenant, okay? They are going to actually make a covenant with Israel. So we'll have these foreigners and the Israelites in chapter 10. They're going to make a covenant to keep the old covenant that Israel was supposed to keep. Does that make sense? So this is not about like arrogance or like ethnic superiority or anything. This is about Israel's place and position in the whole story of God, was that they were responsible to this covenant because God was going to bring redemption through Israel to who? All nations, the entire world. And we already see way back in the Old Testament that foreigners are being brought in all the time. Some of these foreigners were probably part of God's people because their ancestors were Egyptians, and they watched the plagues happen and said, that is the one true God. We're going with him, right? Some of them were probably Canaanites and had joined when they saw. Some were the family of Rahab, right? They saw what God was doing in the wilderness, and they chose to follow him and believed he was the one true God. Okay, so the foreigners are not being excluded. They are among them, and they will be included in the covenant. But it's important to remember that Israel was set apart for a purpose. And here they're sort of separating themselves. The language just reminds us that, oh yes, they bore responsibility under this covenant, and they were supposed to bring the goodness of God to all people, even to those foreigners that they are keeping company with now, right? That's their responsibility. Okay, now the rest of chapter 9 here, they are going to rehearse this story of what their job was, what God chose Israel to do, and what God was going to do, the plan that God was going to work out through this people of Israel. So I'm going to read, I think I'm going to start, oh man, no glasses. Okay, I'm going to start to read somewhere around verse 5. I don't know, I can't see the little numbers, but I can see the words. I think it's verse 5. Here's what I want you to do. If you have not read chapter 9, then read along for the first time and enjoy. If you have read, when I'm done reading, we are going to go to our table groups. And we are just going to, as a form of sort of worship and testimony, we are going to share words and phrases from this chapter that really stuck out to us or stuck with us this week about God's
I'm
character.
I'm going
to
stop there.
We're going to go to our groups and just first impressions from Nehemiah chapter 9. What stands out to you? What are the words and phrases that will stick with you? Okay? Go ahead. We're just going to, it's only about 10 minutes, but we're going to do that now.
Okay.
If someone asked you to tell them what Nehemiah 9 was about, what would you say? What would you say? It's the history. Yeah. Anybody else?
It's how we can't save ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. How we can't save ourselves. Yeah.
And we keep repeating the same thing.
And we keep, there's a lot of repetition. We keep repeating the same thing, sure.
God's faithfulness.
God's faithfulness, definitely about God's faithfulness. Yeah. Yeah, all those things are true. Purely from an observational standpoint, you're right. It's a history. It's a history of Israel. And before we jump to interpretation and say, like, well, we do this and God does this, or this is grace, or this, actually, it's really important to just observe. This is the story of the Old Testament, told in 37 verses. Right? If you ever want to read the entire Old Testament in 37 verses, you can do it in Nehemiah chapter 9. Okay? And you could see, if you looked at it now and tried to break it down, you could sort of see the different parts, I guess, of the life of God's people, or the different parts of the Old Testament. And you could see how God chose to reveal his character to humanity, okay? How God chose to relate
to
humanity.
Up chapter 9, verses 5 to 37, you could just read 33. It says, "You are righteous concerning all that has happened to us, because you have acted faithfully while we have acted wickedly."
What does it say in the ESV? I think it says, let me read this. "Yet you have been righteous in all that has come upon us, for you have dealt faithfully and we have acted wickedly." That is the big contrast, that God is faithful, but his people acted wickedly and turned from him. Yeah. It's a very humbling thing to read, because it doesn't take you very long, well, tell me if I'm wrong, to move out of like this observing what happened in the story of Israel to start thinking like, oh yeah, that's me too, right? I'm a part of this story. I continue to be a part of this story. And I see that I do this too. And yet, the truth is that God continues to be faithful and abundantly compassionate and gracious to these people, even though they keep turning away from him. Okay, so that's sort of 5 to 37, sort of digging into it a little bit. I do think what we need to take from this is this pattern that we see all the way through this whole chapter. And that is this. God is, and then, but we are, and then it goes back to, and it ends with, but God. Okay? And this pattern sort of goes over and over again. And that is sort of the big thing that this whole chapter says. God is this. People are this. But God is this. Okay? Do you see that? See that pattern? Is that fair to say? Yeah. God is faithful. Man transgresses it. But then God is merciful to the people, even though they transgressed against God. Okay. So we're going to look at this next part. So they rehearse this whole story. They get to the end of their whole history. And they basically say, okay, God, you're righteous concerning all this that has happened to us in our whole history. But here we are now. We're slaves in this land. You gave it to our ancestors. We're supposed to be enjoying your abundant compassion. We're supposed to be living with you and enjoying the fruit and the goodness of this special land. But actually, here we are, slaves in it. And so we are, the last line says in the CSB, it says, we are in great distress, which points us back to the very first chapter of Nehemiah, which Nehemiah's brother comes and says, listen, the people of God are in great trouble. They are in great distress. And what is the great distress? They have turned away from the covenant. Okay, so that's how we get to the last verse of chapter 9, which says, in view of all this, we are making a binding agreement in writing, so a covenant, a binding agreement, on a sealed document containing all the names of our leaders and priests. Okay, they are going to now keep, write a covenant, keep or cut a covenant that will tell them that they have to keep the covenant, right? So someone this morning, how did she describe it? Oh, it's like a vow renewal. Like they were lousy at keeping the covenant, so they're going to try again, and now they're going to cut a covenant. They're going to make a covenant so that they can keep the old covenant, or make a covenant that says they're going to keep the old covenant. So they're going to try again, and they're going to include all the people who are in the company of God, including the foreigners who are among them, everyone who can understand the law of God. They are going to put their names to this, and they are going to promise God that they are now going to live according to his covenant. The end. No. And they all lived happily ever after, right? So close, just until chapter 13. And then they will break the covenant again. Okay, but we'll talk about that later. Let's look at that covenant now, just for a few minutes, okay? Let's just go 15 minutes in our small groups. I think it's worth just looking at that. In view of this whole history of everything that they have said is true about God, and in light of that is true about them and how they have acted towards God, here's some promises they're going to make, okay? So we're going to look at page 53 in your homework. If you didn't do it, just open your Bible to Nehemiah chapter 10, starting at verse 30, basically. And we are going to look in our homework at page 53, okay? Let's talk about our answers to questions number 5, number 6, and number 7. The first one is really observation. Try to see, like, what are the three main areas of this covenant they're going to make that's going to help them keep the other covenant? And then how do you see this connected? Like, why is this so important? And then move to application. So then number 6 would be sort of more interpretation. And then move to application. That how do you see these areas actually important for you yourself. Make sense? Okay, go ahead to your groups, and we'll just do 15. We're actually going to come back to these terms of the covenant that the people make. You're going to see them. They're going to come up again this week as you look at chapter 12, 27 in this last section of the book to the end of 13. So I think we'll talk a bit about that. I'm going to leave that now, and we'll talk about it together next time, of why these three areas were what they felt was important and what we should be thinking about them. Basically, just the last thing I wanted to say tonight, let's just sum up what we've talked about here. And that what we're supposed to remember is that in the first part, all the way to chapter 6 of Nehemiah, the wall is being rebuilt. That is the focus of Nehemiah's work. And from chapter 7 on to the end of the book, the focus changes because, surprise, at the end of chapter 6, the wall is built. in 52 days or 51 days, whatever it is, right? And Nehemiah's work, we said last time, we said that Nehemiah's work shifts to what? He's rebuilding what? The people, that's right, and their identity. So we saw that this was really important last week when we said, okay, a big, really important part of their identity is to read the law, the book of the law, to remember who God is and who they are. We can say the exact same thing about chapter 9, can't we? This is reminding the people what is true about God and therefore what is true about themselves. They are actually, the people are being restored here by being restoried. They're remembering their story. And they're rehearsing the story of how they became a people. And it reminds them, this is who we are, and this is whose we are. This is our identity. God is good and faithful. As humans, we are not faithful to him, but God has mercy. Sometimes we call that a gospel arc. And you can sort of stretch it out or fill it in little places, but basically that is what I would say is sort of the bone structure of the gospel arc. And it is a story that's key to our identity, that there's this good creator, that he makes man, and he is kind and loving to them. He wants a relationship. They rebel against him, turn away, and then he does everything he can to bring forward redemption and salvation until one day that is accomplished once and for all, right? That is a gospel arc. And that gospel arc, or that story, if we can call it that, is also key to our identity as the people of God today, just as much as it was to restoring the identity of these people and bringing about renewal and restoration. It is the same thing for us today. It defines our identity today in the here and now. And here's the thing. We are forgetful people. Israel were forgetful, obviously. They were very forgetful, but we are also a forgetful people. God is faithful, but we forget. And we turn to so many other things, and we marry our hearts to so many other things, and we give our affection away to other things other than God. And we don't take care of people with the resources that he has given us, and we don't trust in him as the one who has done the work or accomplished the work even. And so we need to remember. We need to be restored ourselves. And I just wanted to say, I hope you start to see, like, hey, that's what this is about. That's what we come to women's study. And that's why we are so focused on let's study books of the Bible, because then we hook them back into the big story of God and we remember who God is and who we are and what this particular story tells us about God's whole plan and the whole story. And that is actually what Sundays are about. That is what we do on Sundays. So if and, you know, in case you haven't maybe picked this up coming to Crossroads or something, but it's not, as we gather on Sundays or any time, this is not just about our friends are here. This is where we find fellowship. Sometimes we do say that. We gather as a church to rehearse this story that God is faithful, that we have transgressed God's faithfulness. We've turned away and refused to listen, and yet he has been merciful to us. And that is what we do. We do that as we sing, you know, listen and we to the songs that we sing. And I know we talk about this often as a staff, that when we come, we want to start by singing songs that are like praising God and saying, here's who he is. He's this good creator. And then we sing the next song that we just sang on Sunday that says, we are not who we should be, right? We haven't obeyed God. We haven't followed God. We haven't lived into our identity. And then we sing songs that then say, but Jesus, thank you for the cross. And then we sing songs that say, like, fill us, make us your people. Like, let us go out from as we are scattered. Let's continue to live in this story by living by the power of your spirit to see your kingdom come in all the places that we are scattered to as people of of God. It's, that is what we're doing on Sundays. We go there to rehearse the story. We rehearse it as we pray. We rehearse it as we take communion every single Sunday and remember who we are and who God is. So not only do we do this sort of corporately, I think that we actually need to think about how we do this personally. And certainly we do this by committing ourselves to studying God's word and times of prayer, like our own individual like prayer time. I know people this morning were talking about journaling and ways that they can use their journaling time to journal, like, here's how God has been faithful to me. And here's actually how I have not been faithful to him. But now I'm just going to write about God's mercy to me through the blood of Jesus that covers this sin, like his death that has paid for this sin that I have just acknowledged. And we should do that as we reflect. It sort of shapes our prayer, I think. But also I think we can use rhythms of the calendar. The people of God use the feasts, right? That's why God instituted the feasts and all their holidays that they were supposed to keep, because it reminded them of this whole story and who they were. And we can do that now. We are moving now into this season of Advent. The season of Advent is a really great time to personally, in your own life, rehearse the story of a good God who has been faithful to you and who, in his mercy, has met your sin with his son, this child that we think about on Christmas who is sent, and how that goes forward. I mean, Easter, you can think about it all, but you might choose to do it also. Then you can build it into other rhythms of your life. Lots of people here have children. If you have children, having children is one way that sort of forces you to rehearse the story, because you're telling them these stories, right? You are telling them the story of the Bible. You're reading them the story of the Bible, or you're talking to them about these stories that they're hearing, and you're showing them that actually this is our story too. We have become, God has made us part of this story. And in our families, we like to do that. Like, birthdays are a really good time where we stop and say, like, hey, let's all talk about how we've seen God's faithfulness in this person's life. And now we're going to pray for God to be faithful in the next year. And you know what? If you have milestones or rock piles in your life, I would tell you, like, highlight those things, mark them, right? The people of God, they marked them. We have a few things in my family. If you want to ask our kids, like, how has God been faithful? They're probably going to tell you one of three things. God sent us to YWAM, and it changed mom and dad, and it changed their marriage, and it changed our whole life forever. That's what they will tell you, just because they've heard that. Secondly, though, they will tell you that God answered a prayer and did a miracle for us when we first moved back here. And they will say, Molly got into school. We came back and there was no way she was going to get into school, and after a month, we prayed for a whole month, and at the end of the month, on September 30th, the school called and said, okay, the teachers decided they can take two more students, and your daughter is the one. And our kids just said, we were praying, and God was faithful. And then they would also tell you, God was faithful to heal Hattie when she very badly broke her arm, my youngest, when she was 3 years old, an open compound fracture, and the doctor said, it is full of bark from the playground, like, this is going to be a really bad situation. And, like, God did a miracle. And I mean, my kids remember, we sat on Hattie's bed and we prayed and God answered us, and they look back to those things even now, and you know what, like, things are happening even these weeks that they are going to look back and say, but God was faithful. I have told this little thing, pardon me, but I've told it almost every single time we've ever had a story, but or ever had a study. I always say this one little mini sermon, and I have to say it here again. So forgive me if you've heard it a million times, but we are forgetful people. We need to rehearse this, right? And I need to tell myself this week too. So I've been saying this since 2012 in this Crossridge Women's Study, but I think that we need to know this story because we need to view our circumstances in light of the story. And we need to view everything that's happening with us and see how it fits into God's big story. So this is how I always say it. I say there's two places that we can stand.
We can stand in our circumstances, and then we can look at God. Okay? And in our circumstances, we can say, well, I'm lonely, I lost my job, things aren't working out, like this feels unjust to me. Whatever our circumstance is, we can stand there, and then we can look at God, and we can say, well, God doesn't really care. And actually, God has no compassion for me. It feels like he doesn't care. And actually, I don't think God is doing anything. I think he's pretty passive about it. And you can just stand rooted in your circumstances, trying to make sense of God. And you're going to go wrong, and you're not going to come up with a list that says compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, and full of unfailing love. Or the other thing is, you can stand in what you know is true about God. And you can say, the Lord, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and rich in steadfast love and faithful to his covenant and never abandoning his people and not destroying those who put their trust in him. And then you can look over at your circumstances, standing in the dirt of what you know is true about God and say, okay, it feels like this. But I know God has compassion for me. I know his heart hurts and he grieves with my grieving. That he actually has love for me and he's gracious. Even though I'm like feeling upset, he's not going to abandon me. I know God will be with me. I know he has great love for me. So obviously, like, he knows what is for my good, and he is going to make that happen. Why? Because he is faithful to his people, and he is faithful to bring about his good. I know he is going to rescue me and bring me through this. And also, I know that he will always be with me, right? And that actually changes how you think about your circumstances. It does not mean that things aren't hard. It doesn't mean that you don't have a few temper tantrums sometimes, or that it feels awful, right? And even sometimes, like, you could say, it feels unfair. And yet, as I stand in my circumstance, I look at God, or I stand in the character of God, then I look at my circumstance and I say, okay, God must be at work here. Maybe there's something he needs to do in me. Maybe he is faithfully bringing out a hidden idol that I don't even know about. Right? And suddenly you're looking at that circumstance in a completely different way, standing rooted in what you know is true about God. I think unless we know this story, that God is faithful, that we will always choose to turn away from him, but that God will pursue us relentlessly in mercy and compassion to turn us back to him, I think we have to be rooted in that story in order to see our circumstances maybe in a more like gospel lens, or a way that, no, this is like life. God is working, and these things can be for my good. Every day he is pursuing us. Every day he is forgiving. Every day he is having compassion. Every day he is warning us. Every day he is delivering us. Every day maybe he will be handing us over to what we think is best for ourselves. And after he has warned us sufficiently, and we keep saying, no, but we think we know. No, I'm pretty sure I know. Pretty sure I know what's best, God. Finally, after abundance of patience, what does he do? Sometimes, okay, here, you think you want this, but I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay here. And when you decide that you're ready to turn back, and when you realize that I do know what's good, I'm not going to leave. I said to the people this morning, I had this picture in my mind the whole time I was reading this. Sometimes I think, you know, I'm going along here, I'm living my life, and sometimes I'm like, whoa, God, like, you got to get over here right now. Like, I am in the deep, like, mire. And he comes running over and he helps me. And, like, I can call him anytime. And almost like, you know, that part in Nehemiah on the Wall where they blow the trumpet and he will always come. And Nehemiah 9 showed me this picture. I have got this wrong. Like, that God is always right like this. And he is actually inclined his ear towards me. He stoops to listen and to make himself available to me. And I'm doing this, like, I'm over here, like, oh yeah, then I come back. And then, okay, I'm off here. God has not moved.
His posture is always inclined to me in compassion and graciousness, slow to anger and steadfast love. I think it's really important that we remember that. Also, it's finally really, really important to remember that these people are in the middle of the old covenant, which they are about to break. Like I said, chapter 13, you're going to read it this week. Okay, they're going to make this covenant. It sounds so good. They are signing it. They are sealing it. They are certain. This covenant is going to help them keep that covenant. We'll just keep covenanting to covenant, to covenant, to covenant. And pretty soon, we're going to get this. We're going to do it. We're going to keep this, right? And it's not going to happen. This is the last book of the Old Testament, the final book. And what we ought to see is that there is a need for a greater covenant. Why? Because we are not faithful, right? The middle part of that story. And God is faithful. In, 400 years, once we get through that intertestamental period, which there's a lot of silence, then a voice is going to cry out and say, make way, prepare the way of the Lord. And the Messiah, Jesus, is going to be born. And Jesus is going to live a perfect life. He is going to fully keep the law. And then he is going to die on the cross. And in his death, as his body is broken, he is going to sit and tell his followers at the Last Supper. And they are going to start to see, okay, what? This is the new covenant in my blood that I make for you, my body broken for you, my blood poured out for you. I am keeping this covenant once and for all, once and for all. And now you can trust in me, and you can have not only have relationship with God, I'm going to come live in you. Because I have satisfied the terms of this covenant on your behalf. God will not abandon or destroy us, even though we turn from him, because Jesus eternally, through not just his death, but his ongoing life, even now as he's alive, he is eternally keeping the covenant on our behalf. Thanks be to God, right, for Jesus and his sacrifice. This week, I just pray that we would be women who have this knowledge of God's gracious and compassionate and faithful nature, and that knowledge would turn our hearts, first of all, to thanksgiving, that we would be so thankful, but also that it would cause our hearts to just turn back to him. Because the work is that we need to do is actually not like working out there to keep that covenant, like being a better Christian, like not doing this and doing that and not doing this one, but doing that. Our work is to just keep turning back to Jesus for his work, right? And to keep coming back to him and putting our full trust and allegiance and love and devotion to him. Well, friends, thanks for studying along. And remember, for any of the resources you heard in the teaching podcast, check out crossridge.church/wstudy. We'll see you again soon.